This episode of the Blackzit Global Podcast is sponsored by Blackzit Global Passport. Join aspiring Black expats, and repats, where you can build community, get resources, and gain support along your journey abroad. You're invited to join Blackzit Global Passport. Inside Passport, you'll find exclusive workshops on everything from expat taxes, financial planning, insurance, job boards, accountability check-ins, and more. You can even take Passport on the go with our app available for iOS and Android devices. Just click the link in the episode you're listening to or visit blackzitglobal.com and click on Passport. See you inside.
I feel my mind just kind of expanding because I get to do this, again, this version of my life that I had been dreaming about forever, literally. And I think doing it later in life, you're not looking for fantasies. You're not looking for a quick fix. You're not looking for like, oh, all my problems disappeared. Your problems will come with you. They just speak Spanish now. Okay. Like, I still have to pay taxes, you know, like that idea that it's going to, I think this was the perfect time for me because I was very clear why I was doing it. And so everything else is like gravy.
Close your eyes and imagine living a life you love, unapologetic and unbothered, free from daily microaggressions from Karens and Kens, free from the fear of police brutality and systemic racism. Wouldn't that feel amazing? Now open your eyes. What if I told you that it's possible? Hear inspiring stories and get the actual blueprints from brothers and sisters of the diaspora who are living out their wildest dreams abroad. You've heard the term, now be inspired by the movement. I'm Krishan Wright, and this is Blackzit Global.
Y'all, I'm excited for this episode of the Blackzit Global podcast. Because my next guest and I have been trying to do this calendar thing for a minute, and I've been a fan of her journey, and I'm so delighted that we are able to put our voices on this track, and what I know will be a great conversation. My next guest is Lori L. Tharps. She is joining today from Malaga, Spain, y'all. Welcome to the podcast, Lori.
Thank you. It's so great to be here.
Oh, I'm so excited. As I stated, we have been trying to do this for more than a minute. You are a writer and a podcaster as well. Fellow podcaster. I love it. And you have this incredible journey. And I always love to start my conversations with understanding people's origin story, because I feel like that has, you know, nuggets and seeds that eventually blossom into where they are in their journey today. And so I would love it if you would take us back and you can start wherever you feel most comfortable.
Well, Krishan, I am a storyteller, so I can tell a long version of my kind of origin story. Or people could just read my memoir, Kinky Gazpacho, to get the full story. But the idea of like how I ended up in the south of Spain really began because I was a Black girl growing up in Wisconsin. Also, I like to call it Caucasia. I was surrounded by whiteness, white culture, white people, and lots of snow for my, you know, early years. And I really, really idolized Josephine Baker. Like, she's from the Midwest. She was from St. Louis. She was a dancer. I was not a dancer. Let me be clear. I have no dancing talent. However, entertainer, like, she was this like person with this oversized personality and just wanted to be allowed to be her full self and couldn't do that in St. Louis, couldn't do that even in like New York and, you know, the big cities because she was Black. And I felt like I couldn't be my full whole self because I was Black growing up in this very, very white spaces. And I wasn't like traumatized. I didn't have a horrible childhood at all. I mean, I really had what most people would consider an idyllic childhood in the sense that like I went to a good school. I had friends. You know, I was a competitive swimmer. I did drama. I did all the things that I wanted to do. But always in the back of my mind, I had it that I was going to have to go to Paris, like Josephine Baker. Only I took Spanish, so I was like, it's got to be Spain. But other than that, me and Josephine, we're like, you know, mano a mano. Like I'm going to just live her life. And along the way, I decided I wanted to be a writer. Like from very early age, I knew I wanted to be a writer. So I had this kind of vision for myself of a global international lifestyle where I'd be, you know, packing my typewriter because I'm just that old and like traveling the world, telling stories, like maybe being a journalist, a novelist. It didn't really matter. Like I literally was like patterning my life like after Josephine Baker, right? That I could take my creative energy, which was around writing, and like move to Europe. And somehow my life would just become this wonderful thing. I had the experience of going to Morocco as an exchange student when I was in high school, which was in the late 80s that I was there. So, I mean, this was like the first time I'd ever left the United States. It was major culture shock. I lived with a family where nobody spoke. Well, I shouldn't say that. I had 8 siblings, 8 sisters, 3 brothers. And most of the kids learned a little bit of English in school, but really only one of those people spoke. One sister spoke English. She spoke really good English, but everybody else spoke Arabic. They didn't even speak French in the house because the mother didn't speak French. So I was really in a very different situation. It was very challenging at first, but by the end of my experience, I was like, yeah, I got to get out of the United States. This is amazing. Like the idea of seeing how a different culture existed, different language, different customs, different food, all these things. It just like blew my mind wide open. And I was like convinced, yep, my whole Josephine Baker dreams, that's the way to go. Get out of the United States. And this is where you're going to find your real life. So fast forward to college. I did spend my junior year of college in Spain, which was supposed to be the beginning of my adventure. And unfortunately, I didn't have a great time because like racially, as being a Black girl in Spain at that time, I was in a small town. I was not in Madrid or Barcelona or anything. It was not racist, like in an ugly, painful way. It was just like annoying because nobody knew anything about Black people. It was like everywhere I went, people would stare or point at me or ask me dumb questions. Like, do you know Naomi Campbell? Like, can you dance like Michael Jackson? You know, just stupid stuff. And like, you know, blackface during the holidays and things like that, that just, and to be fair, it wasn't just me. Like there was an Asian American girl in my group and like people would call her Toyota. Like, I mean, it was just awful in the sense that, again, it wasn't like painful. It was annoying. And so my Josephine Baker dreams quickly died. And by the time I left Spain, I was like, yeah, I'm going to have to get a new dream. Like, this isn't going to work. Like my whole vision of what the world, what, you know, Europe was going to be like, it just didn't live up to the fantasy. And, you know, keeping in mind, of course, at this point, there was no internet. Like there was no way for me to really know what living in a European country was, except for my, like, you know, reading history. So that being the case, I would have probably just ended up living a very American life, except I married a Spaniard. And so I met him during my junior year and, you know, we went back and forth, all these crazy things, whatever. But we eventually got married, but he came to the US and we made a life in the United States. And like for the next 25 years, my life was pretty normal. And that dream that I had, that Josephine Baker, be a writer, living all over the world. I mean, I even wanted to be a writer so that I didn't have to. I mean, I was thinking location independent in the 80s, okay? Because I was like, if I'm a writer, I can live anywhere. But, you know, we got married. We had 3 children. I got a very good job eventually in academia. And like, I'm 30, I'm 40, I'm almost 50. And my life did not look like that fantasy that I'd had as a young person thinking about my Josephine Baker life.
Yeah, it's interesting. And I want to double click on that for a second. So you were talking about your experience and living in the States before you took the leap of studying abroad and some of those earlier experiences when you moved to Spain during your study abroad that didn't live up to this, you know, built up fantasy life that you had. You know, Josephine Baker is, you know, a luminary for so many of us on this journey, as well as, you know, James Baldwin and and another ancestor, Tina Turner. And so there was something that you said, and maybe, yeah, there was something that you said about, you know, the annoying experiences that you had during your trip to Spain and comparing it to, I guess, maybe some of the, you know, experiences in the States. And like you had said that you didn't have like a painful or a horrible time, but I'm curious, is it that the experiences in the United States, all that they are, right? Whether they happen to you directly or things that happen to Black people in the United States as a collective. I'm curious, do you think that it kind of desensitizes us a bit to when we face racism or discrimination in other parts of the world that it's like, well, it's not as bad as the United States, right? I'm just curious. I didn't want to put words in your mouth, but I think that's where on your story, I was just like reflecting on what you shared.
Well, it's interesting because, again, growing up, I didn't have, it's almost like because I was always the only Black girl in most of my, you know, my classes, my extracurricular activities, et cetera, I didn't experience what, you know, I experienced microaggressions. Of course, we didn't have that word then, right? It was the kind of, and it, so it took me a while to realize what the problem was. You know, like, you know, I really wanted, you know, I was a total drama kid. I really wanted to be an actress. And so I did all the school plays in high school. And it wasn't until I was like a sophomore where it dawned on me that like, why do I always play the sassy maid or the, you know, the character who can sing and dance? Remember I said earlier, I can neither dance and I can't sing either. So it was like, and why was I always asked to do the Martin Luther King Jr. I Have a Dream speech in February? You know, it's like that kind of thing where it was like, I am literally just the color of my skin. Like, I am not a full person to these people. I am literally a walking stereotype. Oh, you're so articulate. You know, it's like when you grow up like that, it takes you a minute to be like, wait a minute, this isn't the good life, right? This I'm tap dancing for my accolades, if you will. And God forbid I step out of character or I do this. So it's like, I thought if I went out of the United States, I could be whoever I wanted to be. I wouldn't have to play these games, these rules of what does Black mean. And when I went to Morocco, for example, I experienced that for real because in Morocco at the time, and again, everything is kind of dated because things have changed. But in Morocco at the time, I was treated the same way. I was with a group of like 10 American high school students. And there were two other Black girls with me. One of them was Kareem Abdul-Jabbar's daughter, which was kind of fun. But yes, so she was like a celebrity because everybody loved her father. But we didn't know who she was because she didn't tell us who her last name. Everywhere she went, she was treated like a celebrity. We're like, who is this? You know, we're like, Habiba, what is up with that? She's like, oh, I don't know.
We oh my gosh, how was, cool is that?
I know, that's kind of cool. I was like, all right. I was like, the Black girls, we're getting all this special treatment because I was always hanging out with Habiba, right? Anyway, the point is, in Morocco, my blue passport elevated my, like, that was the first thing people saw me. It didn't matter me, the blonde girl from California. It didn't matter. Like, my Americanness was the only thing people had, quote unquote, expectations about. There was no, well, you're Black, so you must be like this or you must be like that. It was like, wait a minute, these people aren't like judging me as a Black girl. They're just like, all of us are the same. And that's, it seems kind of hard. It seems strange that I'm saying it, but I guess if you've always been like pointed out differently, like, oh, that's the Black one. Oh, that Lori's the Black girl. Oh, she's the Black girl who does the swimming, or she's the Black girl. You know, it was like, that's the only thing people saw of me. And then I go to Morocco and it's like, oh, what's it like in America? You're an American. Tell us about your country, blah, 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 blah. So that was like the first time when I realized what it felt like to be viewed not by my race first. And that was a revelation. And so then when I go to Spain 3 years later, it was like the Black thing. It was like, Black, there's Black girl. Like, literally, I was just like, people would point and be like, Morena. Like, the first thing they could say was Morena, Chocolate, Negrita. Like, you pick the term for Black, we're going to call you that. So it was like, wow, here I am in a worst case scenario, because at least in the States, nobody's like yelling at you on the street or just coming at you straight on, like, tell me about your blackness. Whereas in Spain at the time, it was like, oh my Lord, can I breathe? Can I just be? Can I just exist without somebody, you know, pointing out, like I might have forgotten that I am black, right? So it was, again, in retrospect, I can look back on it and really compare, you know, what, I mean, I don't even bother, like, what's worse, what's better? I mean, I think they're all microaggressions. I would call them all microaggressions, but those wear you down, whether you're in the States and being told you're articulate and, you know, here's all these black things we want you to do to represent the race, versus being in Spain and it's like, do you know Naomi Campbell? Like, I'm not exaggerating. When I'm like, really? Like, literally every black person they could think of, they'd be like, do you know her? Are you friends with her? Or you look just like Tracy Chapman. Do I? Okay. I mean, no harm, no foul, but like, do I really? Or, you know what I mean? So basically I was just tired, you know, like I blame myself again to a certain extent, thinking that there might be a place in a European country, which makes no sense, but I was young, but thinking that there could be a place where I would be, again, free to define blackness myself without all these preconceived notions laid on top of me. So I don't know if that answers your question, but I do.
Yeah,
know.
No, it does. And as a follow to that, you know, you talked about meeting your husband and then, you know, going back to the States. And I'm curious, I guess, two things. One, how was that transition? Because one part of it is you making the decision after you've had this experience and exposure that, you know, didn't live up to the expectation, the ideal, right, coming to the States. But then also, you know, you had this passion and desire to write. And as you mentioned, you transitioned ultimately into academia for a portion, not to mention your husband, who's a Spaniard, then trying to acclimate to the American culture. So what was that like?
Well, one thing that was amazing for me personally, again, because I grew up in such white spaces, like, and then having that kind of disappointing experience in Spain, you know, what I realized I needed was, you know, to be around black people, like plain and simple, because I also went to college in Western Massachusetts, which my particular college was more diverse than my high school, where I was literally the only black female in my entire graduating class. Like anybody would, I think any place would have been more diverse, but my college was more diverse than my high school, but I was in Western Massachusetts. So, you know. So what did I do? I moved to Brooklyn after college. I moved to like the blackest, most amazing place in the world. My first job was at, after grad school, I went to grad school, got a master's degree in journalism. I worked at Vibe magazine. I was like blackity black girl, lived in Fort Greene, Brooklyn. I was like, just surround myself. It was like, I was reborn. I found my black self. It was amazing. And so, you know, I basically made a kind of like a vow to myself that, you know, all of America isn't white and I can be very intentional about being in black spaces. And so, you know, we stayed in Brooklyn. Both of my boys were born in Brooklyn. And then when we moved to Philadelphia, again, we were very intentional about picking a neighborhood that was literally 50-50 black and white. Our block, which was shocking to me coming from Wisconsin, which literally Milwaukee, where my hometown is always in the top three most segregated cities in America. Always. Since the time I was born until now, it is the most. So like there were no, it was like white neighborhood, Latino neighborhood, black neighborhood, but never the two shall meet. So when I tell you that we lived in a neighborhood in Philadelphia that was like black, white, black, white, black, white, black, white, random Latino, you know, on the one block, that was like amazing to me. So my children did not grow up like I did. My children had black teachers. My children had, you know, black doctors. I mean, things that I had never seen growing up, which is, you know, what the problem was, right? So when throughout my adult life that I was in control of, I made sure I was always surrounded by and in conversation with and in community with Black people. So that allowed me to kind of like, I don't want to say heal, but like become who I really needed and wanted to be. And so then I could look at the world differently in terms of, you know, my ideas of wanting to live abroad as a child were about, like, they were escapist fantasies. You know, I was following this fantasy like a Josephine Baker who literally legitimately needed to get out of the United States because, you know, that there were no choices for a Black woman at that time. Whereas I had plenty of choices, and but I was still looking at it like somehow Europe was going to save me from American racism. Oh my. I mean, when you even say it out loud, you're like, how dumb can you be? But again, I don't blame young Lori. Like, what did I have to go on? And the world wasn't so global at the time in terms of understanding what was possible and what wasn't possible. So that gets me to how we got to Spain the second time. But from like an identity perspective, I was so much more confident in my own skin and who I was and what it meant to be Black. And my children were older because there were other times during that like 25-year period where we, my husband and I, considered maybe possibly moving to Spain. I was like, I am not raising my Black children in Spain after what I went through. I was like, oh, no.
Oh, wow. So that, I'm curious. So, you know, you were talking about that 25-year span and the fact that your husband's a Spaniard. So a desire on his part to go home or reconnect with family. And for you, even the mention of it, it sounds like brought up that trauma of, wait a minute, that's a no-go. Like, we just carved out this life here. I'm intentionally Black, right? And now you try to take me to a place I don't want to go.
Mm-mm. I was like, I've seen too much. And also, like, this sounds really terrible, but like, so my children are obviously biracial, right? I mean, they're mixed race. And each one of them came out looking very different. One is my eldest son, has very dark skin. I mean, he has this almost the same skin color that I do. Curly hair, like closer to Afro texture hair. My middle son is very pale with very loose curls. And my daughter, people are like, is she Indian? Is she Mexican? I don't know. What is she? You know, the point is Spain has a problem with all of the people that my children look like, right? Meaning people who look like gypsies or Roma people, they get discriminated against. Moroccans get discriminated against, right? So like, even though like people would think, oh, dark skin, that's what's, you know, dark skin African, maybe that would be the most, you know, discriminated against phenotype, right? And I'm not saying that if you look like you're coming from sub-Saharan Africa, that you wouldn't be discriminated against, but there is, because of geopolitics, right? Like, we know that there is issues between Morocco and Spain. And again, things are different now. I don't mean to suggest that today, like specifically actually where I live, there's a lot of Moroccans. It's very like, it's a different world than it was 10, 15 years ago. But I had seen racism, significant racism against Moroccan people in Spain when I was here. And I'd been coming back and forth because my husband's from here. So we would go visit, you know, it wasn't like we never stepped foot back in Spain. And so I was like, I couldn't guarantee that my children wouldn't be discriminated against because they could be mistaken for South American, Moroccan, potentially Romani or Gypsy here in Spain. And I was like, I can't take all of that on. You know what I mean? Like, I can't advocate for even for cultures we don't even belong to, but that my children might be mistaken for. I was like, let me just handle American, plain old American racism. Like, we'll work with that. Like, I know what to say. I know what to do. I know who to call. You know what I mean? Like, let me get Al Sharpton on the phone. Cause right. Like, if that's what I need to do, but I'm not prepared to fight that in a foreign country. So along the way, that those were all considerations that I had because of what I saw, you know, from myself. And also, again, going back and forth and also talking to other people. I had a friend who is biracial. I mean, she's a beautiful woman. She has skin the color of like sand and these beautiful blue eyes. And she told me her year in Spain, people threw rocks at her in the street because they thought she was Gypsy Romani. Yeah. I was like, what? Now, again, this was 20 years ago now. Okay. I
haven't heard anybody talking to anybody.
But as a new mom, I mean, my son is 22. So this is what we're talking about. We're not, I'm not making stuff up. Like, but again, I don't feel like, I mean, things have definitely changed. But along the way, as I'm raising my children, these stories are in my head. And I'm like, yeah, no, I will stick with the American racism. Again, it's not about better or worse. It's just what you know and what you're prepared to deal with as a parent to safeguard your children. And I think the biggest thing was in the United States, even if there's racism, which of course there is, there's also a lot of beautiful culture, right? There's so much goodness about being Black in the United States. Like, you can find your people, you can find the culture, you can find the books, the movies, the magazines, the museums. But if you're in Spain, it's not like there's all kinds of great ways to like build your children's identity up with their, you know, their Black identity. So I did not spend my years of raising my children thinking, man, I wish I could raise them in Spain. No, I did not. I did not. So like I said, my son is 22. My other son is 19. And then my bonus baby, she's 12. So she was a bit of a surprise.
But, I like that. That's like my siblings. They're two years apart. And then there's a big 9-year gap. I get it.
Yes. So yeah. So then we actually ended up here. Now we moved to Spain in 2021 in the middle of the pandemic. Because it was like kind of a slow thaw. I spent almost 10 years not coming back to Spain, even to visit my in-laws. My husband, he visited a few times, but really having kids, my husband went back to school to get his degree. Like, we didn't have a ton of money and it was just expensive to try to take a family of five to Europe. It just didn't happen. But when I finally came back for the first time after like a 10-year break, I was 2019 and I got a fellowship from my university to do some research because I literally decided to research how Black people were treated in Spain. Because a lot of, as you probably know, Krishan, this is when the kind of the Blackxit began, really. There was a real exodus of Black women, particularly moving to Spain, both from the United States and from the UK. And I'm watching this from the US thinking, what, are these girls crazy? Like, why are they going to Spain? You know, like, really? And they're talking about it like, oh, I'm so free. I'm so happy. And I'm thinking,
I got to school, y'all.
This is the same Spain that I went to? What? So I went back in 2019 with my podcast, you know, my recorder. You know, I did a lot of audio interviews and I created this like audio memoir is what I called it. And interviewed a lot of different Black American and Black British women. Like, why Spain? Why now? Like, do you feel better here or there? And I was there for 6 weeks, my husband and I and all three kids, we rented an apartment. So rather than like visiting my in-laws, we were living in the city of Cadiz. And I was like, oh, now I remember what I loved about Spain. You know, the lifestyle, the delicious food, the nap after lunch. and talking to all these different Black women who were like loving their lives, I started to just rethink, like, what was it that made me feel so like anti-Spain in terms of being a Black person in Spain? I mean, I want to be clear, like, I wasn't anti-Spain. It just was like, it's not a place where a Black person would thrive. That was my thinking. But in addition to interviewing all these women, and I interviewed women who lived in, you know, all different parts of Spain. It wasn't like I just listened to people who maybe lived in a big city. I was talking to women who were all over the country doing different things. None of them were retirees. These were all women who were doing their own type of work, whether it was some of them had bought a bunch of property and were basically doing Airbnb. Some were, you know, had gotten jobs for Spanish companies. I mean, it really was the gamut. But I also, for myself, I was like, I'm not uncomfortable anymore. Nobody's pointing at me anymore. Nobody's shouting out chocolate, morena. Like, Spain had chilled out. Spain had gotten more aware of what I mean, just for sake of making it easy, of being politically correct, if you will, There's a lot more Black activists here in Spain, meaning Spanish Black activists, not, you know, Americans or British trying to teach people what to do. So it was a whole different atmosphere. It felt totally different. And again, I was more grown. I was more comfortable in my identity. So after 2019, I looked at my husband. I was like, you think we should move to Spain?
And he's like, babe, did I not bring this up before?
Like 18 times. But it had been, like, again, essentially those dreams that I had of the child came back full force. Like, this was the thing. This was the dream since I was, you know, 9 and reading and watching the Josephine Baker stories. Like, that dream was still in me. And I was, like, mildly disappointed with my life, even though I love my life. Like, I had become a really well-known writer, journalist, you know, had written 3 books by this time. I was, like, living that life. But, you know, those dreams you have when you're little. Like, I know you have your New Zealand dream, right? You're like, don't know if it makes sense, but it's always been there. Right. So I had that, like, me and my typewriter traveling the world. And so just those 6 weeks in Cadiz that summer made me, like, it opened up that box that I had hidden and said, like, it's just not for you. It's not going to happen. So we came back. I applied for a year long sabbatical. We got our kids to get like a year, like, we asked their schools to hold their spot. They both went to public school, but they were like magnet schools. So like if they left, they would have lost their spots. So we were like, you know, we arranged for them to be able to hold their spots. We found schools in Spain for them. And then the pandemic hit. So it was all off. So this whole plan that we were like, we're going to just, you know, take a year, try it out, put the kids in school, let them experience their other culture. Like the universe was like, haha, no, you not. No. So basically, after we got off, you know, off the shock and the sadness, like everybody else. And again, it's like, you can't be crying because you don't get to go on sabbatical when the whole world, you know, people are dying. So we planted a garden. We were like, let's lick our wounds. And then somewhere like halfway through the pandemic, I was like, you know what? Like, one of the things that we had decided was that we were going to send our middle son to college in Europe because they have the dual citizenship. And I didn't want to fork over hundreds of thousands of dollars because one of the things we realized when we were there in 2019, my husband's like high school friends who have kids the same age as ours, they were like mentioning that college was like $1,000 for a year. We're like, wait, what? And right then and there, I looked at my middle son. I was like, you're going to college in Spain. End of story. That's just how it's going to work. And he was like, okay. I mean, he was only, I think, 16 or 15 at the time, but I was like, be clear. I'm not kidding. This is the plan. And so pandemic is happening. And I'm basically like, well, if we're going to send this child to Europe for college, wouldn't it make sense to let him have a year of high school in college? So it's not such a crazy transition. And I've always had this dream. And my husband is really eager to go back home since he's been away for 25 years. And literally we were like, we made the decision. We made a lot of lists, a lot of pros and cons. Some things that happened in our personal life that we didn't own a house. Like, we had sold a house and were in a rental that was going to, the lease was going to be up. So we were going to have to move anyway. My husband's job, he was on a contract position. That position was going to be up and he was going to have to find a new job anyway. And so it kind of felt like, except for the global pandemic part, this actually feels like it could make sense to go now. Now, of course, for everybody else that we were crazy, but that's basically what we decided to do. So what was going to be a sabbatical year became a, why don't we just go for it? Let's just do it. And so we moved in May 2021, and here we are.
Wow, what an incredible journey. And there were certain things that I knew, and then other things I'm just like, wow, like taken aback by. And so knowing that you had these misgivings because of earlier experiences with Spain and wanting to raise your children there, and then now fast forward to ultimately making the decision, taking the leap during a global pandemic, how has the adjustment been for your children? You know, were any of your misgivings or fears confirmed? I'm just curious.
Yeah, no, it's a great question. So just to be clear, I have three children, but only my two youngest came with us because my eldest was already, you know, in his 20s and wanted to stay in Philadelphia. And so we had with us our, he was 17 when he came, and then my daughter who was 10. So they're 7 years apart. And the boy, we actually held him back. So he should have been finishing, he should have been doing his senior year of high school in the U.S., but we actually had him redo 11th grade. Spain's like obligatory schooling ends at 10th grade. So 11th and 12th grade in Spain are kind of like, if you want to go to college, you do 11th and 12th grade, but it's actually not required. You can go to like pre-college school, or you can go to, it's called formación profesional. So like, what do we call that in the States? Where you going to trade tech school? Like
vocational
school. Mm-hmm. Yes. So you can go on either route, and we wanted him to go to college. So actually, we didn't even know enough about the tech. We might have sent him there if we knew more about it, because it's actually quite good. But we were like, yeah, you're going to college. So you'll go to these, you know, the 11th and 12th grade here. We made him redo 11th grade because his Spanish, which we found out, unfortunately, you know, my husband only speaks to my children in Spanish. So they're bilingual, but they're like house bilingual. Like they don't speak academic by Spanish. And so it was very, very hard for my son academically. And we put him in a very good school because these kind of 11th and 12th grade programs are, again, if you're going to college, it's a choice. So these are all kind of, they're all very rigorous, if you will. And Spanish school system is very different from the US. It's a lot of memorization. Not a lot of like, you know, critical thinking. It's a lot of memorization and regurgitating information. And quite honest, Krishan, like the stuff that he was learning, it was like what you would learn as a freshman in college in the US. And so, I mean, he was doing econ, psychology. I mean, it was literally like the, you know, because I taught at Temple University. It was like he was doing the work of the, you know, your basic requirements when you start college. So I really actually wasn't mad that we were making him redo 11th grade. Also because 11th grade for him was a pandemic year. He was in his room. I don't know what he was doing in there. I mean, was he learning anything? I have no idea. I was like, look, you're alive and you showing up, like, fine, you went to school. So for him, the struggle was not, you know, being a Black American, Spanish kid, made friends. It was just the language barrier and how hard classes were. But I was so proud of him because he through the skin of his teeth, he passed 11th grade. He had to take like every exam like three times, which is great that they allow you to. And then when he did 12th grade, he already knew he wanted to go to college in the Netherlands because he was like, I will not do college in Spanish. He's like, I will do college in English. He's like, you can't make me. And I mean, I saw how much he was working, how much he was struggling. And he did make it. And now he is actually in college in The Hague and is loving it. He's studying sports, which is his passion. And
oh, that's awesome.
Loving it. And it gives me an excuse to go to the Netherlands whenever I feel like it, which is great because we love the Netherlands. I don't like the weather, but it's a cool country. My daughter, like I said, she started fifth grade. We did not put her back at all. We found this very cute little neighborhood public school. It was, the school's like on top of a mountain. I mean, and I'm not exaggerating. Like, I think I pass billy goats when I take her to school every day. It's like, I mean, it is on top of a mountain. And because of that, you have to be crazy to take your kids there. So the school is really like, there's only like 11 kids in her class. Like it was a really small school, but that was great for her because it was like a real community. They started every day on the playground dancing. Like they literally had a teacher who came up with a new dance for them to all learn every morning. I mean, super cute, very like, we called it the hippie school. Like all the parents had tattoos. Like it was just like really sweet, sweet school. School started at 9. She was done at 2. I was like, could y'all keep her a little longer, please? But because of that, like she was very scared because she's like, I don't speak Spanish well enough. I can't do this. I'm going to be terrible. But again, it was such a small, tiny class. Everybody was so nice to her. Her Spanish improved, like her grandparents, my in-laws, they could not believe the difference when, you know, she first got here to, you know, the end of the school year. Cause we see them like, you know, once every few months. So they can really see the difference. So she's been thriving. And in terms of like identity, I'm giving myself a pat on the back, Rashawn, because like I feel like I did a good job making sure my children knew they were Black. Like they're just Black. They're Black and Spanish. That is how they identify. They know they're Black. My daughter's like, I gotta take some hot sauce to school, Mom, because their food is so bland. She's like, I'm gonna put it in my pocket. We had Valentine's Day last night, and I was like, what do you want for dinner? She's like, fried chicken and biscuits. Like, my child knows who she is, and she has no problem telling people, explaining, raising her hand and saying, excuse me, you're wrong. So on that level, I feel like, and again, in Philly, like she was in a school with mostly Black students, like she knows who she is. And here in Spain now, and I think it's very different if you're in the south of Spain versus other parts of the country. Like I said, like she's like, there's at least 4 Moroccan kids in her class. There's mixed kids in her class, a couple Asian kids in her class, which again, that was not my experience here 20 years ago by any stretch of the imagination. I would not say it is a bastion of like multicultural diversity, but there's nobody looking at my daughter like, you're Black or what, or what's, you know, do they want to touch her hair? Yes. And she has her slap, slap, slap. Don't get near me. Don't touch my hair. She knows how to maneuver so people don't touch her hair. So she's doing great. And I am grateful that I have found a Spain that, especially in our city, you know, in Malaga, that there's enough diversity. Like my son, like I said, he's very light skinned, but he has Black people hair. But his hair is like Black people variation hair. So he found a Moroccan barber who's like, yes, that's right. And just down the street from our house. So it's like, there's enough diversity here that nobody stands out. Nobody's like, here's a great story. My daughter was at, they had like a camp day, a farm day at the end of school year of sixth grade. And my husband went to pick her up early because she had to go to dance class. And these two men came up to my husband as, you know, my daughter, they're walking back to the car. And they say to my husband, because my daughter had dreadlocks. And they said to her, to my husband, is she a Rastafari? And I was like, oh no, is she? Here we go again, right? Stereotypes. And my husband was like, first of all, he's like, she's not a Rastafarian and neither am I. Like, why would my child be a Rastafarian? But he was like, no. And they're like, well, why is her hair like that? And my husband's like, cause her mom put it like that. Like she wants it like that, whatever. And then these two men took their hats off. They had dreadlocks down to their butts and they're these are Spanish Rastafarians. They were like, they were so excited because they thought that they were finding a kinsman, right?
Oh my goodness.
They had been Rastafarians for years and were super excited. They were like hoping my daughter was one of their kind, but I literally fell on the floor. I was like, oh God, okay, we got to get into the like explaining hair. Nope. They took their hats off and they were like,
wow.
They had long locks and they were like, yeah, we're Rastafarians. We've been Rastafarians for like 20 years and your daughter's so beautiful. And we just thought her hair meant that she was a Rastafarian. We're like, so again, my ideas and like, I'm so quick to be like, oh, you know, yeah, these people. And you just never know. And that's, I feel like Spain has changed a lot since I first got here. And that has been so positive and affirming. Me personally, I mean, you could call me names and I'm fine. Like, I know who I am. I'm okay. But for my children, particularly because we chose this life for them, we wanted them to see what their other culture was like. And we came for very specific reasons because I really wanted to stop working in academia and pursue a creative writing lifestyle. But I couldn't afford that in the United States because of healthcare and college. Again, 3 kids, college. I could not afford to do that as a creative writer. But more importantly, I have epilepsy. I need medication for until the day I die. And without good insurance, I mean, and I also have to have certain, you know, tests and things done on a regular basis. I could afford it out of pocket, you know, like doing something, you know, paying for it myself, but it would have been a burden, a massive burden, not to mention having insurance for four other people. So because Spain has universal health care, I mean, just to give an example, my medication in the United States with my insurance was $25 a month. Here, I thought I wasn't understanding Spanish correctly. I went to the pharmacy and they were like $1.50. And I was like, what? And not just $1.50, $1.50 for a 3-month supply of the exact same medication. And we have private insurance. Like when we first got here, we had to have private insurance because we weren't in the system. So with my private insurance, it was $1.50. But now I'm on the public system. And I went to go get my medication. And they were like $1.04. And I was like, wait, excuse me. I was like, you know, I sometimes mix up. Did she say $100? $1? I like just put some money on the counter and let her make the change. Because I was like, that can't be right. So
wow.
3 months for $1.04 would cost me $25 with insurance. And if I didn't have insurance, there have been times when like I needed to get like just a small amount for traveling or something and like had to pay per pill. And it would be like, you know, over $100. So I am never going, like, I can't afford to be sick in the United States.
Oh, no. No, you can't even afford to die in the United States. Like people, even death doesn't give you relief because the United States is what it is. And yeah. I'm curious because you left your position in academia mm-hmm. and now are able to pursue full time, right? Your creative endeavors. I'm curious, especially with a lot of what we've seen in recent months of either an exodus of Black professionals from academia or unfortunate, you know, deaths, suicides, et cetera. How has this transition been for you, not just from a creative, you know, endeavor and pursuit, but I think maybe, I guess the better question is psychologically, has this benefited you taking, you know, a step back full time from that position, that tenured position, into what you're doing today?
Well, again, it goes back to that dream life that I had for myself. This is going to sound crazy, but I was listening to some, you know, some health podcast or something where they said something like, you know, whatever weight you were in high school is kind of like the weight that your body should be naturally or something like that. And I've also heard like, whatever you wanted to be when you were 6 is what you really wanted to be when you, like, that's where your true passions were. I truly believe that like the vision I had for myself as this creative writer telling global stories from a very young age has always been with me. And so I feel like I have come back to that truth. And so I work really hard. I work literally from the minute I wake up until like I have to pull myself away from my computer. But it's because, you know, the old adage, if you love what you're doing, you'll never work a day in your life. So I spend my days working on my own. I'm writing a novel. I'm writing a nonfiction book. And I spend my afternoons. I have a brand, a podcast, literary podcast. I have a writing group for BIPOC women writers where I coach women. I provide resources. We have events. I have a writing retreat that's going to be in Portugal this year. So like I am doing what I like. Again, if you didn't pay me, I'd still be doing this. But luckily, I can get paid for doing it here. I've set up my life in such a way. So, you know, again, I help other people write. I'm writing my own things. I'm happy all the time. And then there's something about the actual beauty of where I live. I mean, I look out my window and there are tropical trees and flowers. If I go on my balcony, I'm looking at the Mediterranean Sea, which is literally me and my dog walk on the beach every morning. I always say, even if I want to be good and grumpy, I can't stay mad. I cannot, even if I want to be, because this place is so physically beautiful. I have the mountains behind me and the ocean in front of me. And so, like, you know, Black people suffer from, you know, hypertension, you know, things of stress. And I definitely, again, I work a lot, but I feel so happy and grateful and lucky that I have been able to find the life that I wanted when I was 8 years old, right? Like that life that I saw for myself. And because I'm a writer, Krishan, I have journals from when I was 6 years old. I have documentation that this is the life I wanted. I found I don't even know what you call it, but like when you could make desktop publishing, I created a little magazine and it was called Bound for Barcelona. And it was like a black girl on a ship. I don't know if we didn't have airplanes, but like it was this whole fantasy sequence of like me leaving New York City, going to Spain and living this there are documentation from all the way through that this is the life I wanted to live. And I think when you're lucky enough to be able to, you know, manifest the dream of your childhood, you can't help but like feel younger, feel empowered. There's so much excitement there. And like, I just want to say to anybody listening, like, I got here when I was 49. Okay. So I turned 50 in Spain. Like, I turned 50 like 6 months after we got here. And I'm not going to be like, I feel younger than I ever did. But it's like starting over. It's like everything, even doing my laundry is kind of cool because it's different. It's done differently. You're exploring new things, even just going to the grocery store, right? So like, you know, for my birthday recently, we just took a little drive to a different town and it was so exciting. We didn't have to do anything like spectacular or spend a lot of money. We went out for lunch and just walked around. But it's like, I feel my mind just kind of expanding because I get to do this, again, this version of my life that I had been dreaming about forever, literally. And I think doing it later in life, you're not looking for fantasies. You're not looking for a quick fix. You're not looking for like, oh, my problems disappeared. Your problems will come with you. They just speak Spanish now. Okay. Like, I still have to pay taxes, you know, like that idea that it's going to I think this was the perfect time for me because I was very clear why I was doing it. And so everything else is like gravy.
Oh, I agree on so many levels. That resonated with me because I feel like this stage of life, and we're about similarly aged, that even though, you know, this desire to move abroad was a lifelong dream that I held on to since I was a little girl, I feel like this season of life is when it needed to happen. To your point, like the fantasy of it, I wasn't holding on to. And I talk about on the podcast being clear on your why and living life by design and not by default. And I agree completely, like this being here, physically, mentally, emotionally, there's a vitality that is just in everything I do now versus where I was just a few months ago when I was living in the States. And I hadn't really been able to like put my finger on it and articulate it. And so when you said that, that resonated with me so much and serves as a confirmation that it is never too late to pursue your dreams. It's never too late to dream a new dream because for you, right, it also involved dreaming a new dream. And so I want to also encourage anyone who's listening to this conversation that this is what it's about. This transformation, this process, nothing is wasted. And so I really appreciate you sharing that.
Yeah. I mean, one of the things that I, you know, I listen to every episode of your podcast and I get so much from your guests. And one of the things though, I did want to just bring up was that, you know, this has been my dream forever. And, you know, I married a Spaniard. No, but I'm the middle child. Like I'm a classic Aquarius. Everybody in my family knows I'm the crazy one. Like I do weird things. Like I don't fall in line, all that kind of stuff. I went natural before anybody else did. But So I didn't think that me moving abroad was going to be a big, like, nobody thought it was crazy, except that I did in the middle of the pandemic. But recently, my mother became ill. And so we had to have like a big family, you know, powwow and things like that. And it was really surprising to me. People like, well, are you going to come home now? Like, you're coming back, right? And the idea that nobody thought this was real. Like, this was one of those Lori things, like crazy Lori was just doing something crazy. But that is something that I do. It's not a caution, but it's definitely, because I know you always ask that usually, like, what did people think? Or how was your friends and family? How did they take it? How do you make sure that you don't listen to naysayers? But it is something that for somebody who's been dreaming about this for so long, who listens to your podcast and other podcasts, where it seems kind of normal to move abroad at this point. There's a lot more people who this is just not normal for them. And so it might not come up right away that what you've done is crazy or not right or something, but it can come up later in your experience that people weren't actually supporting you, or they didn't think this was a good idea, or they didn't really believe you were going to do it and are still just waiting for you to come to your senses and come home. So that's definitely been something now that it's almost been 3 years for me. It'll be 3 years in May. And I was really actually shocked at how many of my family members from, you know, cousins, aunties, even siblings were like, but you're going to come home now, right? As if they didn't see this as a permanent move, right? So that's just something that has surprised me, because I've been, you know, I went to Morocco. I did a junior abroad. Like, this has kind of been in my, I mean, I'm married to a foreigner, all these different things. And even still, that level, that's this idea of moving abroad is still shocking to a lot of people. And they don't really put it into, like, they don't, it doesn't connect with them the way that I think everybody who probably listens to your podcast does, right? Like, we already are like, yeah, I've already bought into the idea. But I just think that, I guess that's to your, I guess this is for you as a podcaster, like, who's doing this work. It's so important, because we are our own tribe of weirdos, if you will. A lot of people think we're weird, crazy, you know, and it might not come out until after you've gone, when people start saying, like, something happens back home and they're like, you're not coming back. Wait, what do you mean you're not coming back? And so it's just so helpful to have a podcast like this, to know that there's other people out here dealing with these things. But this is the kind of thing that you really do want to be clear. Like you said, know your why, because you don't know who's really not supporting your decision to move abroad. That can come up in ways that you never really prepared for or thought about.
I'm so glad you mentioned that, because I've been dealing as of late with my mom having some medical issues, and, you know, touching base with her more deliberately just to make sure she's okay. And then Rick and Halisi, our Black Utopia, who've been on the podcast and have a YouTube channel, recently entered back to the States to deal with her mom. And so I think that is also an opportunity to talk about that and raise this issue, because, you know, when you make this decision to go abroad, like you said, you know, we're the peaceful crazies, right? We might be crazy, but we have peace. But it is inevitable that something will come up outside of the traditional, like, birthday parties and celebrations, that there also are unforeseen circumstances that arise, whether it be illness, death, or something else, that may, you know, require your attention, or may require that you go back to the States for a brief time, or wherever your home country is. And also harkens, you know, becomes that, like, oh, well, I'm going to take this opportunity, even though nobody asked me to voice my, you know, opinion, or, you know, project my expectation on this person that's doing the thing that either I wish I could do, I can't do, or whatever that person's motivation is. And I think that is where, and we talk about in our Black Sick Global Passport community, is this decision requires that you be in community with like-minded people, because you have to be fortified and resolved and very clear about this. Because otherwise, if you don't have that, it is very easy to get deterred, something to dissuade you. Like, I've been holding on to this for a long time. And there, you know, when I reflect on some journey steps in my earlier years where, you know, people weren't on the same page and I was the crazy one that had this idea who then kept it to herself, right? And it was only through the pandemic that I found my voice to come publicly and share these plans that I was, you know, developing in secret. And then also doing the internal work to be prepared for the naysayers, whether it be friends, family, frenemies, whatever the above. But you're right, this is a part that isn't talked about enough publicly, so that however you're engaging in this content and with this content, that wherever you are in these journey steps, this is a very important part of the journey. And I'm so glad that you raised this.
Yeah, it's definitely something I actually took a course, which I'm sure you have something like this in the Global Passport and things, but I literally took a course before I moved abroad that was like a clarity course that really forced me to focus on my why, because there's two, I mean, even just getting out of the US, right? You need to make sure that things are going to happen. That's going to make you want to give up. But I realized, you know, now 2.5 years later, when, you know, this situation came up, I could still pull on that work that I did to ask myself, like, why am I here? Is this the right thing? Do I need to go back? Since everybody's now like, you coming back, right? And I'm like, no, I'm getting my residency. So not only am I not coming back, I can only stay a little while because there's rules about how long you can be outside the country if you want to get residency. So my priorities right now, son, is stay my butt here in Spain. Okay. So I will be free and flexible in 2 more years, but until then, this is what my priority is. But again, that can only come if you've done the work ahead of time and really understand and have your community, your Blackzig community, whatever your community is, so that you can turn to them, because it will be hard. I mean, nobody's saying be hard ass and don't care about your loved ones if there's something serious happening, but you still have to make the decision about you. Like, you have to make the decision about you and what's best for you, because you can't even take care of somebody if you're a hot mess, or you don't have support, or you don't have any money or health insurance in another country. So that is my like words of wisdom now, almost 3 years in, because it came up and it took me by surprise. I mean, luckily, like I said, I had done the work, but it took me by surprise because I didn't realize people had these thoughts about my moving abroad. And that's the thing, you know, people will smile in your face and say bon voyage, but they have different thoughts, like for real.
Yes, let your haters be your motivators. Because bye, we ain't coming back. So, Lori, I've enjoyed this conversation so much. As we start to close, where can people find you?
Well, if you're interested in any type of reading, writing, writing coaching, writing workshops, please check out my platform, which is readwriteandcreate.com. And that's actually R-E-E-D, writeandcreate.com. If you spell it wrong, I own both URLs, so it doesn't matter. You'll end up where you need to be. But I'm all over at, you know, readwriteandcreate.com. And we are specifically a platform to support and celebrate BIPOC writers. And if you just want to follow me, because I'm full of shenanigans, you can find me on Instagram at Lori L. Harps.
Awesome. I will link all of that. Oh, go ahead.
I forgot. And I have a podcast. I forgot. If you
please mention the podcast.
As we're on a podcast, if you are a BIPOC writer and you want some free creative writing coaching, you want to hear from really successful authors how they are so successful, check out the Read, Write, and Create podcast, which was voted best literary podcast by the Black Podcasting Awards in 2023. There you go.
Oh my gosh. Congratulations on that. And yes, I meet so many people either on the show or throughout the Blackzig community that want to share their stories and they don't know how, or they don't know where the right community is for them to allow these creative writing endeavors to come to fruition. And so for any of you, including myself, definitely go to the show notes for this episode, link up with Lori. You already know from the bio that she is an acclaimed writer, so you are in good company. And I am excited for your upcoming book coming out, right?
I'm working on a book. Hopefully it'll come out sooner rather than later. But I do want to just put that in there, Sean, that the reason that I do what I do is because I've been in this business for so long and we need more stories from Black people, particularly stories of Black people who are on the other side of crazy and have moved and lived in other places, because we have to change the narrative that this is normal. Because Black people have been voting with their feet and living all over the world since forever, but nobody wants that story told. They don't want us to be empowered and have agency over our lives. So these stories aren't publicized. They're not promoted. So my goal, literally the tagline on my podcast, is trying to get as many BIPOC writers as possible to get their stories out of their heads and out into the world, because more people need to be motivated by the things that we're doing right now. So that is my ministry in the second half of my life, is to help people like the people who listen to this show, like the people who are on this show, get their stories out there to more people by any means necessary. Traditional publishing, self-publishing, we have the means, and we just need to get people to tell their stories, because that's how we're going to change the world, is to change these narratives that have been, it's just basically been lies on top of lies about the Black experience. And that's why people get stuck, because they believe that we are limited to the narratives that have been told. We got to tell new narratives, get new stories out there in the world, and inspire the next generation to take advantage and to take agency of how their life is going to be lived. Okay, I'm done.
I agree 100%, because that is why this podcast exists. Because when I was looking for a Black expat, you know, I was not finding us. And so I knew we were out there. And I love talking to each guest, including you, because every conversation brings up a different aspect of the journey. And we are dynamic. We are so multifaceted. And so there isn't just one narrative. And especially in a time where our history is being attacked and erased, it is important for these stories to be told in all mediums. And so, like I said, for anyone who's listening to this, you have a story that's on your heart and you want to tell it, and you just haven't found the right venue to bring that creativity to fruition, definitely link up with Lori. She has some amazing resources, and I'll have all of that in the show notes of this episode. So with that, Lori, thank you so much for being a guest on the Blackstick Global Podcast. I am so excited and delighted that we had this opportunity to connect and share your remarkable journey. I'm excited for you and your family in the next chapter, and for all the people that you're helping with Read, Write, and Create. So thank you so much.
Thank you so much for having me. It's been an absolute like fangirl moment to finally be on Blackstick Global Podcast. And like I said, we're doing our Read, Write, and Create retreat in Ericeira, Portugal, which is just a little bit above Lisbon. So maybe we'll see you when we're there in September.
Ooh, all right. You look, I haven't been to Ericeira yet, so I'm excited.
Whatever you just said does not sound like how I pronounce it. I'm going to work on my pronunciation, so I'll stop calling it. Portuguese vexes me. I need to practice.
It's okay. Look, I'm only 5 months in, so I get it.
Thank you for listening to the Blackstick Global Podcast. For more information on today's episode, be sure to visit our website at blackstickglobal.com. It's not only possible to live out your dreams unbothered and in full color, it is your birthright. Are you trying to sort out health plans, banking, VPN, and other connectivity for your move abroad? Well, have no fear. We've got you with the Move Abroad Starter Kit. Get yours today at blacksitglobal.com/resources. That's blacksitglobal.com/resources.